You are now part of a social experiment.
Welcome to Mastermind, the show where you learn to develop and master your skill from the best of the best. Here's your host, Mr. G.
Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us today on the journey towards self-mastery. Our next guest is an inspirational speaker and an educational consultant. He's inspired and shared his story with millions of students across the country for the past 20 years. At a young age, he made some poor decisions and got involved in a Brooklyn gang. At 15, he was shot 6 times at point blank range. One of the bullets hit his spine and his life would change forever. Since that time, he's learned to forgive and has traveled all over the country and the world telling his story, inspiring and teaching young people to be the greatest version of themselves, as well as teaching emotional intelligence, conflict resolution, decision-making skills, and character building. His story has been featured in the book, Why Forgive. He's also been given presentations to the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, middle schools and high schools all over the country, Yale University, Purdue University, Harvard University. Let's welcome today Mr. Hashim Garrett to the program. Mr. Garrett, how you doing today, sir?
I am doing well. Thank you for having me, Mr. G. Pleasure to be here with you.
The pleasure is ours, man. Absolute pleasure having you on the program, man. And I really honor the work that you are doing because I think certain people can get into the minds and the hearts of people experiencing things at the time. Because, you know, being an educator, working with some young people, they're always telling you like, yo, you don't know what it's like, man. Like, you know what I'm saying? You don't, right. You know, you're not really in the life and you can't tell me anything kind of thing. But with you, you know, you've experienced so much good and bad that you do know what it's like. And you can really get into the hearts and minds of young Black kids the way that others can't, man. So I do appreciate the work that you're doing.
I appreciate it. Thank you for the acknowledgement and recognition. I do appreciate it, brother.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, man. Before we get into your story, man, I kind of really wanted to tackle a little bit about gangs, man, because I feel like when we look at gangs, a lot of times we think about like, yo, these are the worst people in our society, the black on black violence and this and that and the third. And we don't really look into it. And a lot of gangs kind of started as a result of protecting the neighborhood or protecting themselves because other gangs was getting, you know, bothering them or whatever it was, and had some positive things to start out with. And one of the founder of the Crips, Stanley Tookie Williams, talked about what his experience was like. And a reporter asked him, like, how could you kind of justify shooting somebody that looks like you? You know what I mean? Like, this person has the same background. This is another black person that looks like you, has your experiences. And like, how could you justify shooting and trying to harm somebody that looks like you, especially when we talk about this black on black violence kind of thing? So he mentioned that the core of it was self-hate, and the self-hate was brought about as a result of society's racist views of black men. And he believed in that growing up. He believed that he was less than and he was not worthy. And that self-hate kind of led him to prey upon people that looked like him. I kind of wanted to kind of get your viewpoint on that assessment right there into gangs and kind of like what they're all about and why somebody would be harming someone that looks like them and everything. So what do you think about what Stanley said?
Well, I don't, you know, honestly, I don't think things are always that black and white, you know. Life is more gray than black and white. Like, I think self-hate is a component of it. But it is not the only factor and variable as to why we do the bad things that we do, right? So, yes, a component, but not the only factor. And part of the reason why I say that is because when you look at, let me use myself for example, right? Because I don't want to say how that maybe that's how Stan Tookie Williams felt. Right. So let me say from a Hashim Garrett perspective, why did I do the things that I did? Right. So I can only speak from my own experience, truly, because everything is not black and white. Right. I've worked with a lot of kids. So just for a second, I'll tap into just working with a lot of young people and, you know, meeting young kids. A lot of them are not doing it just because of self-hate. You know, a lot of kids are not joining gangs just for self-hate, because you got some kids who just literally want to be down. And they think like they come from a background that their mom is home, dad is home, dad is this, a professional, or dad is blue collar mom. Like, and you go, why are you in it? And they just, they the class clown. And they think this is cool. They just want to be popular. And they, you know, and they see all of the girls around the kids and the gangs. And, you know, sometimes teachers give all of these kids attention. So everything is different. Then you got some kids who join it because their families were gang members. Their father is an OG. Their father and their uncles and cousins are gangs. So is that really about self-hate? Nah, they've just been indoctrinated into this lifestyle from the day they were born. You know, I've got friends who were in the mafia growing up in Brooklyn. You know, Brooklyn is diverse. You got one section is Jamaican and the other section is Italians and the other section is the Russians. The other side, you know, so we all a combination, and every hood got its gangs. You know, every hood. You know, I'm black. I don't go into Bensonhurst because they got the Italian gangs over there. Are they doing what they doing because of self-hate? I don't really think so, you know. So from my perspective, from me growing up, it was really a combination, you know. The component of the self-hate that I can truly attest to is there is good and bad in all of us, right? That the picture of the yin and the yang, right? Mm-hmm. No one is all bad and no one is all good. Mm. So when we are conducting ourselves, when I was conducting myself and I was a little kid and I'm running around with guns and doing all of these terrible things to people and to society, I was so confused. And the self-hate component that I can say is I was hating the things that I was doing, which you would say, but then why are you doing it? But I can't figure out a way how to get out of the situation now. So, you know, sometimes they say, if you're in a ditch, the number one thing you should stop doing is digging. You know, mm-hmm. I've been married for a long time. And sometimes your wife will just look at you like, you should just stop talking right now because you're making the situation worse. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
You know what I mean? If you should really just stop, if I was you, I'd stop. And, you know, you work with kids in school and you're like, they're getting in these arguments and fights and the teacher's coming around and putting their one hand over the other kid's mouth. Like, just stop talking. And that's that lifestyle of like being in a gang. You're like, okay, I'm in it. I know what I'm doing is wrong. And I can't quite figure out how to get out of this. And you hate what you do, but you just keep doing it. You know, it's a self-destructive. I know what I'm doing is wrong.
Right.
But why does it feel so good though? Like I'm drunk with power here. Mm. Like people respect me. People fear me. I know this isn't right, but I like it though. Mm. But I know it's not right and I don't like it, but I do. That's why I say things are not always black and white. There's just that, you know, that's the confusion of it going. And, you know, hopefully when we can stop looking at gang members and realize, wait a minute, yeah, the husband or the wife that's cheating, you know what you're doing is wrong. But you still like what you're doing though. You understand? Like, so we can always point our finger and see the bad in the gang members, but how often can we just stop in our adult self and go, yeah, there was a moment in my life when I was confused too. Absolutely. Was I picking up a gun and shooting somebody and robbing and doing all of that? No, but he who's without sin, let him cast the first stone, because we are not all good and we are not all bad. You know, gotcha. And did I, you know, and I, the stuff that I was doing, I knew it was wrong, but why did I keep doing it? Why did you continue to have that affair? Why did you continue to, you know, do the things at your job that you weren't, like all of us, none of us are perfect. So gotcha. That's mm-hmm. where I think the whole gang thing comes, the component of is like, yeah, there's a little self-hate. Yeah, it's true. But there's also a whole bunch of other reasons why young kids join gangs. You know, so part of what I just wanted to share is just as quickly as we look at gangs and these kids and people who are involved in that kind of lifestyle, just look at yourself too. You know, I'm no holier than thou, you know, and I've been confused plenty of times. So just keep that in mind when you're looking at another person and you quick to label how bad and nefarious they are. Look at yourself too.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Great, great points, by the way. Definitely a lot more than that, even though it is a component. But let's tackle, you know, your life and the lessons from that. So, you know, take us back into growing up in Flatbush, Brooklyn, before the neighborhood started getting changed and all that stuff. Like, what was your experience like there? And I know you moved there, so we could even take it back earlier than that. Just some of your childhood experiences that kind of led you to where you were at, you know, like we mentioned before with the gangs and stuff like that. But what was your childhood experience like growing up? Obviously, you didn't just pop up into a gang and looking for things that are absent and stuff like that. So kind of wanted to tackle what things were like for you and painting a picture for us into Hashim's life and your thought process before things all got started.
Oh, okay. All right. So I would say before the gang. So grew up mom, dad, and grew up in Flatbush, as you mentioned. And Flatbush was a neighborhood where, from my earliest memories, right, it was just, I felt so peaceful. It was so tranquil. It was like a little utopia to me. It was beautiful, right? I don't have any bad memories growing up. You know, I would say most of my bad memories started when I was about 8. Prior to then, pie in the sky, just beautiful, you know? Remember as a little kid, my dad worked a lot. And then at a point, him and my mother weren't together. But so I was really, from my earliest memories, really raised by my mother. But my dad was always in my life, but he just wasn't in the home. And so I'm a little kid. I had the Superman sheets. I had Fonz. Yeah, I mean, some of y'all may not remember the Fonz, you know, some TV show. Fonz, you know, lunch basket, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Just a regular kid, man. Mom's, you know, say a prayer before you go to sleep. She get on her knees right there next to me, and now I lay me down to sleep. Pray the Lord my soul to keep. You know, if I should die before I break, pray the Lord my soul to take. You know, you got to run through the whole list of every single person in your family you're praying for. Start with grandma, start with your auntie, start with them. Pray for everybody. And those are my memories as a kid. I remember, you know, going to Rockefeller Center. I remember there was a business in the Twin Towers before they collapsed. It was called the Windows of the World. My mother taking me to those. She was always big about just experiencing things outside of my neighborhood, you know? So you go to Midtown and we go have sushi at Japanese restaurants and Radio City Music Hall and go to Broadway shows and Mama sings the blues, stuff like that, you know, always experiencing me the culture. So my mother's, her background, she was a college graduate, you know, studied English. So she always taught me the pen is mightier than the sword. You know, you got a problem with somebody, you write it down. My mother's big for, oh, okay. So my pops is he's the brawn over brain, you know? You know, right. My mom's the brain over brawn. So she's like, oh, no, I got a problem with you. I will write it down. I will write the governor. I will write the senator. I will write your boss. I will write, like, she understands the power of the pen. My pops, on the other hand, he understands the power of the bullet. You know what I mean? He's like, you finish writing and I'll go punch him in his face. And let's see who will humble him first. You know what I'm saying? So I grew up with that dichotomy of, okay, yeah, you know, and but again, I was raised by my mother, so dad wasn't in the household to teach me how to box and all of that kind of stuff. I understood how to be loquacious. I knew the intellectuals, you know. My mom's side of the family, they migrated from Jamaica, so you know they owned brownstones and they were professionals. My grandfather was a tailor, and I had aunts who were principals and got an uncle who owned a magazine. So, you know, coming from the educators and lawyers on her side, and pop's side of the family was the total opposite. So again, just growing up, prior to eight, all I saw was just culture. All I saw was experiencing different things, travel to Jamaica, visit family. But then when I turned 8, my mother my mother and I were evicted from our home. And so everything changed literally overnight for me. You know, I'll never forget us leaving the home that we lived in Flatbush and then moving to Bushwick, Brooklyn. And this is like 82, 83. I didn't even know drugs existed. I didn't even know there was violence in the world until I was 8 and I moved to Bushwick. And I was like, this is the same, not just the same city, like, you know, the same borough, but I was like, this seems like a different world. There was violence, you know, there was drug dealer, there was sirens, everything just seemed so different. And so growing up there, I had this I lived there from 8 to 15, and literally it was.
And where's Bushwick in relation to Flatbush?
Literally, I would say about 20 miles away. You know, the borough of Brooklyn is the fourth largest city in America. You know, it's a huge city, you know, and each neighborhood has its own level of toughness and criminality, you know. But I'm not saying that Flatbush didn't have these areas, but I never saw it. And but Bushwick, it was just rampant. It seemed like it was everywhere. And so Bushwick neighbors the towns that Bushwick neighbors Bed-Stuy, and I think on another end it might neighbor like East York, Brownsville. So it's you know, it's in the middle of certain other little neighborhoods in Brooklyn. And so growing up living in Bushwick, as I was saying, I was there from 8 to 15. It was really 7 years, but it felt like 27, 37. I aged living there. You know, all of the innocence was taken away. I watched my mother be abused by her alcoholic boyfriend. You know, I watched police come into the house. I watched people getting robbed outside my window. I watched people getting jumped outside my window. I watched people, you know, get hurt. And so all of the innocence of whatever I thought the world was vanished. Those were the years that I was bullied. Those were the years that I joined the gang. And so, you know, those were some really, really difficult years. And so for me, as difficult as those years were, I think in hindsight now, those are the years that I kind of lean on when times get rough in the current day. I go, well, if the creator of all things, if he could bring me through that and I'm still here, then whatever I'm going through now, I can lean on that and say he's been with me since my youth and he didn't forget me. So if I'm still here today, then I have to trust that he'll help me through this difficult time too, whether it's the pandemic or whatever it might be, you know. Those early years prior to Bushwick were all fabulous, you know. But then the subsequent years were the arduous times, you know.
Got you. I know you mentioned the bullying. So what was like your school experience like at Flatbush versus what it was like at Bushwick, and how did that bullying impact you as a kid coming up?
The Flatbush experience, again, utopia. I went to a Muslim school when I was a child. So my name Hashim is my God-given name, my birth name, you know. And my cousin who named me that, she just recently passed away a few days ago, Nadia. So may her soul rest in peace.
Yes.
But so I went to a school, and I remember, right, my earliest memories of going to school was, my bus driver wasn't a bus, but it was a van, and it was all black, pro black. It was called Yehira Sasa on, I want to say that was Bedford Avenue. I think it's Marcus Garvey in Bed-Stuy. And I'll never forget these brothers, Brother G, they would come to my house, man, and they were the guys who take you to school. And this guy, like, was big, man. He must have been Now, I was a little kid, but to me, he looked like he was 6'8", 300 pounds with a big beard. And he was the guy that drove us to school. I had the kufi on and, you know, and take you to school. And everything was brother such and such and sister such and such. And, you know, I felt so protected, you know, so protected. I mean, from They walk you to the van. You felt protected on a school property. It was just love. But then I recall, you know, that was probably like my first grade in kindergarten. And then we, whatever, for whatever reason, my mom's and then they put me into your regular public school. And I'll never forget just the difference. Like my first school, everybody was black. Everybody. Black this, black that. Everybody was black. And it was pro-black, not just your regular black. Everybody was pro-black with respect. And it was just, I had never felt anything quite like that. And even to this day, one of my goals has always been to open up my own school. You know, I've always wanted to, you know, I want to be able to replicate that feeling for other young people. You know, when they come into the school, quick sidebar, they come into the school, you know, men are men and women are women, you know, and we take care of kids and we teach them skills. We teach them like I just got this vision of what I want to teach kids and what I want the school to look like, you know, just a legacy that I can leave behind for young people. But then I recall, you know, going to another school and all of the teachers were white women and it was different. It was different, you know, and just kind of like shaking my head and going, yeah, I miss the days of seeing all the brothers that was picking me up. It was definitely a different vibe, man. And I remember talking with my pops, and my parents are still alive, thank the Father in heaven for that. But I remember talking to my pops and he was telling me, you know, he grew up in the deep South, right? Because my dad is 80 years old. So his grandmother, you know, they were sharecroppers, you know what I mean? And so when he grew up, he was telling me about what it was like when all of the teachers were black, you know, because it was a segregated South back then, you know? So all the blacks was in one area. And so he said, but when he came up here to the North and his family, you know, they migrated to Brownsville, Brooklyn, back in the 50s. And he was like, you know, the teachers weren't black. They were white. And they just talked to you different. The kids up here, they didn't even respect education. So I say all of that to say, he was just like, you know, the kids in the North, they didn't value education the same as the kids in the South. But he also kind of said the teachers, because maybe they didn't quite look like the kids, they didn't have the same sort of intentionality to make sure that those kids succeeded, you know? So I often have wondered, you know, what those years would have looked like had I continued to stay in an environment where all I saw was people that looked like me who were really, really vested in my future because they knew that, you know, that next generation, that younger generation, the same little baby's hands, that same brother who was holding my hand to make sure I got onto that bus, he knew that in 30 years, I was going to hold his hand to make sure that he was well, you know, when he was an elder, you know what I mean? He was vested into his community, you know? And so, so now I get back to your questions. Growing up in Bushwick, and not to say that the teachers that I had there weren't good teachers, you know, but it was a different kind of experience because they did not look like me. You know, I had a science teacher named Mr. Holder at PS 296 back in Brooklyn. And he was one of my favorite teachers. Part of the reason, I'm sure, is because he was a black male. You know, he was a black male teacher and he cared, you know. But the bullying that I experienced, honestly, it started way before I even got into the school. The bullying was on your way from the house to the school. You know what I mean? You get past. We call the trains in New York the Iron Horse, man. Like you gotta make it to the school, bro. You gotta make it. Try, you know what I mean? Let's see if you can get past these dudes who want to rob you for your sneakers. Let's see if you can get past, you know, the guys on the corner. Good luck, man. Good luck. Go ahead. By the time you get to school, you're like, whew. Class is over, right? This thing is over for the day. Like, nah, man. You know, so, and then you go outside and the kids, I got robbed from my bike outside. I got robbed from my sneakers outside. And so, you know, going to school, it was just like, it was just phase two of the bullying and the trauma, you know, because that's not the way the world should have to be, you know? So,
absolutely. Yep.
So you get to school and then, like the kids outside, they rob you just because you're fresh. They just want the materialistic stuff. There's no, you know, there's a certain amount of trauma, but it's not psychological. It's just like, you got what I want. I want it. And what you going to do to keep it? You can run and you can keep it. If you can fight, you can keep it. If you can't do either, well, you coming up off of something. You know what I'm saying? But in school, it was totally different because in school, you got picked on just for being smart. You know what I mean? You got picked on because you were two shades darker. Like, what the hell, man? Like, you know what I mean? You mean to tell me because I'm black, like I'm dark skinned, like I'm subjected to a certain, or you too light, bro. You too light, man. You know what I mean? Like what kind of weird backward universe do I live in? I don't know. Maybe white kids deal with this, oh, you too blonde, dumb blonde jokes, and you're a redhead, and I don't know what they deal with, but I know in my community, man, like, yo, this dude is light, bright, and almost white, and this dude is dark as mid. You understand? This dude
bringing
is dark
back memories right now.
You know what I mean? Like, yo, don't close your eyes. This dude closes his eyes. You won't be able to see nothing. Oh, he's blue black. And what kind of BS is this, man? You know what I mean? Like, you know, and so you get past all of that, yo. And then, like, please don't be the dude that you too smart. Now you not black. And then that kind of mindset. So what does black mean? Mm-hmm. So black, you know what I mean? Like, so then you start trying to figure out life in a setting, and the teachers is looking at you and they cannot relate to this whole us dissing each other about how dark you are. They ain't nobody stepping in to say, all right, forget today's lesson plan. Let's talk about the comments that I'm hearing. That's all flying under the radar. You know, ain't nobody teaching us self-love, and nobody's teaching us about colorism. We teaching this to ourselves, you know? And so then in the midst of that, then when people start telling you, you acting white, because you are articulate, and what kind of message is that sending? And so now you got to play dumb to get along. And, you know, the whole idea and the concept about the kids in school who get all of the accolades are never the smart kids. You know, there ain't no trophy case in near any city school that I've ever gone to, really, where they got all of the straight A students. But you see everybody with the trophies and for what they do athletically. So you look around and like, you know, being smart in a city, in a black communities, is not nearly as widely praised as it is for your athletics, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's the reality. You know, that's the reality. So you're like, all right, well, I don't play ball, so I'm not getting recognition for that. You know, I'm not singing and dancing. I'm not getting no recognition for that. So, and if I raise my hand too much, these dudes in the back talking about they want to punch me in my face because, you know, you acting white. So you start figuring things out. For me, I just started figuring out, all right, cool. And, you know, I go home and I'm telling moms about, and I don't want to go back home and tell her, yeah, I'm getting picked on and getting picked on, because I'm supposed to be the little man of the house, you know? So just trying to figure it all out. So I'm being raised in a very maternalistic environment. You know, my mother lives on, me and my mother live together and two floors down in the apartment building that we live. My grandmother and my great grandmother lived there. So I have women on top of women. They're not teaching me how to put my hands up. And so, yeah, like, all right, nice guys finish last. And so what I did learn very early is that if you're not getting acknowledged for athletics, you're not getting acknowledged for your singing and dancing and being a class clown, you're going to get acknowledged for being tough. And, you know, tough. So joining a gang was just by default, just part of the survival skill, you know, and part of being acknowledged. Like, and so, again, just by default, you get involved in that kind of lifestyle. And, you know, in all honesty, I know I didn't join a gang at 11 years old because I was trying to throw my life away. I wasn't joining a gang at 11 years old because, oh yeah, I just can't wait to, you know, go to jail or hurt somebody. You just want to be accepted. That's really all it is, you know? Right. And you're trying to figure things out, and you're 11. You don't understand life and death. You don't understand going to jail, and you don't really understand. You know these words, but you don't understand it. And so, nor did my peers. And one of the things I realized later on, after getting shot, being in the hospital and all that kind of stuff, that if I was in a gang and it was like 50 of us in middle school that were in gangs, you know, ranging from sixth grade, seventh and eighth grade, or that kind of stuff, each and every single one of them were going through something traumatizing at home. All of them. Hmm. Each and every single one of us was dealing with some type of hellish experience at home.
And not getting help.
Not getting help, you know? And the only help that we truly got was from one another, you know? And what we found was, you know, that old saying, hurt people, yeah, you know? Yeah. Like we were really hurting, and our comfort was either self-medicating, right? At an early age, yo, the older kids, yo, here go a beer. Yeah, here go some liquor. And we don't even realize that we self-medicating. It's not we just get high. But you found yourself laughing more than crying, you know? And you weren't making a correlation like, okay, when I X equals beer and friends equals, you know, this right. is the equation. You didn't get it. But in hindsight, you're like, oh, wow. You know? And, but like I said, it was those kind of retrospective looking back, realizing, oh, yeah, we were all going through something. And at the end of the night, here's something I'll tell you. At the end of every night, when everybody had to go home now, that was where you saw the kid again.
Mm.
That's when you saw the kid. You like, yo, why y'all staying out late at night? I don't want to go home. Like, I don't, but I got to go because you leaving and you leaving and you leaving. And then the toughest of the kids is like, it's roaches everywhere, man. Mom does not home, bro. And dad is not home. And the abuse, like, I don't want to go home. Like, just stay outside with me. And you like, I can't, man. I got to go. And you walking him and he's walking you to your house because he's trying to just spend as much time out the house as possible. And he starts talking to you like, yo, can I stay with you for the night? Nah, I can't, you know? And you like, and those are the moments you don't realize it until later, like, yo, my friend was crying for help, man.
Right.
And I was crying for help. I didn't, that night was a good night for me. And then, you know, this wasn't a good night for him. And next thing you know, dude started having kids. And next thing you know, they get a girl pregnant and they're trying to figure out, yo, can I stay with you? Like everybody just, I don't want to go home, man. Hmm. And home is supposed to be a safe haven. And you'd rather be in these streets. And so then you turn around on the news and you'd be like, yo, what happened last night? Because everything always happens at night. You know, you'd be like, yo, I just walked them home. I know, son, he got killed last night. Damn, man. And then that's the next wave of the drama and the stress that comes along. Because he was like, I was just with him last night, man. We was all together. And then that's when the anger comes. And that's when that depression comes and all of these different feelings, you know, but people just sometimes don't understand the fear that kids have to go back home. There's a lot of abuse that's taking place, right? So
yes, I think that makes, we need all of that. We need all of that because I think that a lot of people look at like, you know, why would this kid make this type of decision? Don't they know what these gangs are about? Don't they know what these gangs do? Don't they know they was going to be involved in this? And don't they know that? And like you just mentioned, it's really not even about that, man. It's about finding that sense of family. It's about being protected. It's about, you know, all of these things that you mentioned. Not only that, the decision-making skills are not there. And we all know that. We all know that the prefrontal cortex, you know, the decision-making part of the brain is not developed at a young age. Because, you know, when little Johnny does it, it's okay. He's just being a boy, but, you know, or he's young or whatever it is. But when we do it, it's like, yo, that's a monster right there. What's wrong with them? You know what I'm saying? So I do think that, you know, a lot of us understand that, you know, these things is not just like, these guys are not just monsters, but the decision-making skills are not there, and they're struggling with trauma, with pain, with depression, like all that stuff that you just mentioned is, you know, what leads to, you know, these guys saying like, you know what, the gang is my family, my brothers is my family, you know what I mean? And I want to be around them 24/7 and whatever we got to do to survive, I'm getting bullied in school, whatever, you know, let's make this happen. So you kind of transition into that life as a result of, you know, your experiences, the bullying, things going on at home and everything. So at what point did you, was there an initiation into the gang, or did it just come around as a result of y'all just hanging out? And then how'd it come from just hanging out to, all right, we doing this, we doing that, and doing some of the stuff that is involved, obviously, in that kind of lifestyle?
Well, I was in multiple gangs, you know, so I didn't grow up in the era where Bloods and Crips was rampant in New York. Bloods and Crips at that time, growing up in the 80s, was on the West Coast. You know, Chicago had its gangs. Now, mind you, the gang that I was in the sixth grade through eighth grade or so was just your local gang of kids. You know, by definition, a gang is three or more people who engage in criminal activity, you know. So for me, it just started out as playing hooky, and you cut school. That was day one or week one of just cutting school. And then that was the sixth grade. All right, well, and that was the exciting part, was cutting school and running away from truant officers and not getting caught. That was the exciting part. Ooh, you did it, you know. There was no violence, just cut school and figure out a house to go to. And when you get to the house, then what do you do? And then, all right, well, you can't hang out in that person's house. All right, well, let's go to the park. Yo, let's dip from the truant officers. And the exciting part was just not getting caught, you know? Mm-hmm. And you did that a few times throughout the week. And then, okay, all right, well, we've been doing that. And how much fun is this now? And then when you hang out in the park, then there's a hierarchy of, okay, we're all in the park. Yo, y'all should fight. You two fight. Yo, y'all fight. You know, and now it's a pecking order. Who's the leader? Who's the top dog here? You know, and you're like, oh man, like, I thought when we all got together, there was a brotherhood here. Like, I thought we all, you know, part of the reason why I'm with y'all is because, you know, part of the reason why I joined the gang was I'm trying to be down. I thought you guys was picking on me. We picking on, now we, like, you know, so I engaged in that kind of activity because I'm getting picked on from the kids. So I figure, all right, they're always picking on me because I'm smart, always picking on me for this because I dress nice, whatever the case is. Well, now I'm starting to hang out with y'all. So I would think that all of this bullying stops. Now it don't stop. Now we all together, now we're going to just bully each other every now and then just to see who's tough, you know? And it's like a pack of wolves, you know? There's an alpha, and there's got to be somebody who's underneath him and so on and so on. And so, you know, in the beginning was just kind of like figuring out your pecking order in this gang lifestyle, and then you're cutting school. Well, that works for the first few weeks, but the more you cut school, then the idle mind is devil's workshop. So we got nothing to do. So let's think of something stupid to do. Like what? Well, there goes a kid that I don't like. Let's get into a fight with him. Instead of us always fighting each other, we already decided who's the toughest, who's not, who's this. So I say, you the tough one, go punch him in the face. Or, you know, so there was no initiation. We just kids, right? Mm-hmm. And so we all the same age, you know? And so we just trying to figure things out. We got no leadership. So, we, you know, it's the blind leading the blind. Ain't nobody telling us how to be in a gang and what you got to do. We just all figuring it out. All right, so you the leader, you know, by osmosis, just we kind of figured you must be the leader because you could beat five of us up. All right, cool, he's the leader. Without, you know, non-verbally, none of us saying it, right? And then, all right, well, you at the bottom of the pecking order, since you ain't too tough in here, in order to get some extra points within our gang, you go punch this kid in the face. If he swing on you, you fight him. If he getting the best of you, we all jump him. All right, well, cool. Now you raise your pecking order status. Yo, you saw how he punched that kid? Da, da, da. And that's how I went for a few weeks. And then next thing you know, you start getting in the fights with other kids. And, well, you remember that kid we beat up the other day? And you got your pecking order? You got your status up? Yeah, well, his friends are now coming back, and then comes the stuff, the fights with other kids. And well, now remember that fight that we had when we jumped that kid? Well, his friends are coming back. Oh yeah. Well, since they're coming back, what do we need now? We need weapons. You know, it just, it's a gradual dissension, not progression, you know, is, gotcha. And so you gradually find yourself going, all right, so now we are carrying weapons because of the decisions that we've made and people are retaliating. Okay. You know what's interesting about carrying weapons? What's that? You could commit robberies with a weapon. Mm. Oh, right. So you're like, I didn't carry the weapon initially to rob the store. I carried the weapon because the kid that we beat up wants to attack me and he said he's coming with weapons. Okay. Got it. That makes sense. Well, now we're carrying weapons. And you're like, okay. And now we're committing crimes with the weapons and it's like a slow process, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's really how it happened, you know, from that group that I was with. And then I got introduced by those 50 kids that I was with, or 40 plus kids that I was hanging out with. Next thing you know, you meet other kids along that are older and they're like, yo, I don't like some of your friends. These are the older guys in the neighborhood. Like, I don't like some of them. They just knuckleheads. They just do stupid stuff, but I like you. Mm. You get an older kid who's taking you under the wing and they're like, yeah, I like your style and you should, you know, you could be down with me. And now you're with a new crew, you know? And so that's kind of just how it worked, you know, where you just find yourself running with this crew and you're friends with these guys. And they're like, oh, okay, well, you know, when you're not doing that stupid stuff with your little friends, listen, if you want to get some money, this is what I'm doing. And mm-hmm. It's networking 101. It's not even 101. It's networking 100. Like, you know, people like, yo, yeah, I saw y'all dudes. Y'all kind of wild and y'all kind of stupid. Like, yo, but, and everybody gets their own mentor.
Right.
Everybody, you know, so out of all 50 of us, yeah, well, there's going to be some older kid who's like, all right, you know, I don't gravitate to him. But some of my other friends gravitate to him, and then and I gravitate to somebody else. So even as kids, you know, you always, people are watching you. That's like the adults; they see the kind of dumb things that you're doing. Mm-hmm. But you also have the older kids who are watching you, and they're seeing that you're making a name for yourself, and they're like, "Hey, how would you like to be on my team?" Mm-hmm. You know. Right. And it's kind of like the Pee Wee League. Then you get to high school, and then just like, you know, in sports, you got the scouts who they looking and they saying, oh, I see a nice little prospect. Yeah, I see what he was doing in high school. Well, you want to join here? And that's kind of what it's like, you know. So people just watch and they go, you should think about getting a part of us. And then you say, well, why? And then they make their pitch to you and they say, well, you know, with us, this is what we doing over here. And how that sound? You're like, okay, it's the same kind of same format.
Got you, man. That's a great analogy right there too, man. Like just that whole process of how everything kind of unravels into, you know, you actually, you know, putting in work for another group or whatever it is. So, you know, you get into kind of more things in the gang and, you know, more violence and doing stuff. You kind of get to a point where you kind of like, yo, I don't really want to do this no more. What got you to that point where you're like, I don't know about this, you know, as opposed to the excitement in that fun phase?
I think for me, the fun part, just as quickly as you get in it and you like it, you know, from the beginning, like I like it, but I realized that this decision that I have made wasn't the wisest. You figure out very early on. But the one thing about the gangs, which is so different from any other thing that most young people become engrossed in, is I've got two children and my children will tell me in a heart, you know, like, yeah, I don't really want to do this anymore. And be like, all right, cool. That works for me because I really want to keep driving you, sitting and waiting in the car for you, paying for this. So I'm kind of cool with it too. So it's no biggie. You know, but then there's certain things you're like, nah, you got to stick with it because you need this. You know, I know you're not swimming. You don't got that. You're still in a little guppy phase. You're ready to get out of it. But this is a life skill. You got to do it, you know. And so even when they want to back out of it, you tell them, no, you got to continue. Whereas with the gangs, you go, you know what? I'm 11. I really don't want to keep doing this. This is kind of stupid. Yeah, well, you're not getting out just like that, bro. It don't work that way.
Mm.
And that's the part about gangs is that, yeah, it's kind of the easy thing is to get into it. The hard part is really trying to remove yourself from it because you literally have to remove your entire family. You can't just walk past these kids tomorrow and be like, hey, I'm not longer hanging with you because you go from predator to prey, you know? And so, and if you decide you want to relocate, well, good luck for your family because they will easily be like, oh, because they don't want to be in it. And then they see that you got out of it and they feel some sort of way. And now they want to, you know, figure out some way to make your family's life a living hell. So you realize very early, like, oh my gosh, what have I gotten myself into it? Part of the self-medicating is realizing I'm stuck. And I have a lot of kids who have spoken to me over the years. And that's the number one thing that they want to really talk about is when we get to that place that they could be honest, right? Mm-hmm. When they get to that place where they feel comfortable enough to actually verbalize this out loud and say, I really don't want to be in this. I don't know. And when they know how to articulate it, right, and they not fronting and putting up the facade, they go, Mr. Garrett, I don't know how to get out. I really don't. Not like I don't physically know how to just get out, but logistically, physically, financially, like my family, like, and I get it.
Mm.
I get it.
What do you tell them?
I tell them we gotta be real deliberate about what we do. We have to be very strategic on how we do this. Because this is your life. Like, you tell a kid not to join a gang, all right, get out the gang. And your friends, like, so I let me just make sure everybody understands this. Your friends in the gang, your so-called friends in the gang, they say, all right, because every gang is different. Your so-called friends in a gang are like, cool, you want to get out, no hard feelings, right? That's the best case scenario for you. Wonderful. But your ops don't care. Your ops don't care. Right. The dudes that they did the dirt to, they don't want to hear that you not repping the set no more. Bruh, I'm still taking your head off when I see you. I know you changed, but the way I feel about you ain't changed.
Wow.
So I know you had this epiphany and you had this moment, this aha moment, and you don't want to do it no more. Good for you. Good. There's still a green light. They still want to kill you on sight. So my advice to young people is, and every neighborhood is different, right? Every neighborhood is different. So it's like, so how can we maneuver around it? What do we have to do?
And I think what you mentioned
too,
like,
a plan.
I think what you mentioned too, a lot of adults don't really kind of understand that are not involved in the gang life. It's like, yo, why don't you just get out of it? Why don't you just stop doing it? Like, just stop hanging out with those guys. You know what I mean? Like, they just like, that's it, you know? But like you just mentioned, there's so much more to it than that, man. So it's like, it's such a difficult thing to grasp. And some people are more harsher than others about, you know what I mean, how to deal with it. I know we mentioned Stanley Tookie Williams earlier, and he said like, yo, if you wasn't worrying about, you know what I mean, your enemies when you was in the gang, why are you worrying about how to get out now? Like, that, why is that a big thing now? And I think that it's a lot more complicated than that, man. Like you just mentioned, man, and that's a difficult answer, man.
This is part of what I often try to tell them is that you have to be very strategic, you know, because when you're not in a gang, so to my rebuttal to the comment, like, well, if you weren't worried about them then, well, part of not being worried is just get high. When you high and you drunk, you don't care about a lot of stuff. When you surrounded in numbers and you with a lot of other people and everybody's got guns and it's 100 of y'all and you drunk and you high, yeah, and your adrenaline is pumping, you're not really worried about a lot of stuff. But now I'm asking you to not get high. I'm asking you to put guns away and I'm asking you to be a lone wolf. Yeah, well, now I'm more vulnerable. You know, there was safety in numbers, and you telling me I'm not going to have my numbers, and you telling me that I need to stop drinking and smoking so I can stay on point and stay focused on whatever my goals are that we're talking about. And you're telling me that I can't carry weapons because if I carry a weapon and I pull a trigger, it only takes 1 second for me to ruin my life. Well, yeah, we've got to come up with a plan now.
Right.
We have to have a real plan. And this is part of my conversation with kids. Yeah, we got to have a real plan and we have to sit down and we have to figure it out because everybody is a little different. Some kids, I'll just tell them, go to school, go home and don't go outside. That's the plan. Mm-hmm. That is the plan. And be very, very careful when you go to do things, you know, and just don't let your guard down. Everybody's plan is different. You have a financial advisor. The financial advisor is giving you a plan. He's giving you and I a totally different plan than he's giving the billionaires. Your plan is different. You understand? He's giving a self-employed person a total different layout than he is giving somebody who works a 9 to 5 who knows exactly how much they get. And everybody's plan is a little different. And so as I'm coaching these kids, you know, and I hate to use those terms like life coach and all that kind of stuff, but as I'm just kind of coaching them on how to maneuver throughout life, or being a mentor, that's rather what I say, you know, just trying to mentor them through these difficult years. We individualize, come up with an individual kind of plan for their life on how to move smart, you know?
Yeah. Got you. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense, man. Just, you know, everybody has their own different experiences. Like you just mentioned, like, yo, if this is my whole family's involved in this, how do you maneuver through that? You know what I'm saying?
That's the hard one. That's the hard one is when I'm trying to give advice to kids and they go, but my father is telling me different. See, it's one thing when you got the parents working with you and they like, yes, listen, I told them. And you can just say, listen, one of the hardest things that I've learned over the years is to tell kids, don't listen to your parents. That's one of the hardest things that I've had to truly grasp because there are a lot of kids they parents is their worst enemies.
Absolutely.
Their parents are their enemies. This is the fact. And it's not like intentional, but there are kids that I go and I say in the past, I would say, listen to your mother and father, you know, and then you meet them and you'd be like, nah, that's not good advice. Cause they moms and their fathers is in it. And they like, and even if they're not in gangs, they just not in a good space to be parents. Listen, everybody people have children, but don't know how to be parents.
That is so true, man. And I even get into these conversations with young kids too, man. Like they're like, yo, I'm about to go knock his head off, Mr. G, and this and that and the third. I'm like, yo, what would your mama and dad say about? They would tell me to knock his head off. So I'm like, dang, don't listen to him. Like, this is what you did.
Yeah. We gotta come with a different plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Man. So you dealt with this whole thing, you know, yourself, you know, growing up and involved in the gang, and now you wanted to get out. And, you know, part of that whole thing was, like you just mentioned, like them not allowing it. So were you on to the fact that there was like, yo, not really down with you doing that? And then, you know, obviously walk us, you know, through that May 7th day, man, like where these, you know, things unraveled, man.
I would say, so May 7th, right, is the day that where everything kind of came to a head. I would like really life changed the day I joined the gang. Life changed when the innocence was taken away. But everything came to a climax, to the zenith on May 7th for me. But the days leading up to it, the weeks leading up to it, you could feel the tension between me and my so-called peers. You could feel the tension. There was just these moments of you really looking over your shoulder. Like, I really, some of these, these are not the kids that I grew up with. These are not your 6 through 12, you know, 6th graders and 7th graders that I used to hang out with. As I said, you know, I was with different sets and stuff, different people. And not sets, because it wasn't no name. Like, that group that I was with from 6th to 12th grade, we actually had a gang name. But everybody else after that, it was just your little team of people that you did stuff with. But it was no sets and names, none of that, just people. And but this group of kids that I was kind of hanging out with, and I was 15 at the time, and these guys that I was with, I was 15, and the kid closest in age to me was 18, and the oldest was 22. Wow. You know, so I was a little kid running with the big boys, you know, for my age group, you know, it's like, but I could just feel it, like they knew that I had my eye out on some of them. Like if I could, I'd kill you. You know, if I could, I would, you know, and I could feel it the way they would look at me. They, you know, Beanie Siegel had a song years ago. Said I feel it in the air. Classic, right? And he said, your handshake ain't matching your smile. And that's a classic line. When you give them the dap and you give them the dap and the dap ain't quite the same no more, you know? Yeah. And they give you the dap, but they look at you in the eye and you're looking at them like, yeah, what's good? And ain't nothing. You know, and it's like, all right, it ain't right no more. It ain't right. Mm. It ain't right, you know? Mm. Wifey giving me the food and the food is cold. It ain't right. I'm wrong now.
Man, so you feeling this? Did you have a plan, like... Cause you like,
Mom's had a plan. I didn't have a plan. Mom's had a plan. My mother who gave birth to me and carried me in a womb for 9 months. Her senses was going off. Something ain't right. Cause she would tell me, she's like, Hashem, I don't like these boys right here. I never heard her say that about nobody else. But she said, them right there, I don't like them. I get a bad feeling in my stomach when I see them. And I couldn't get it. I couldn't get that. I didn't understand the dynamics of the mother connection and the umbilical cord. They cut the cord, but we were still connected. I didn't understand. She could see things that I couldn't see. She could feel things that I couldn't feel. I had become numb, you know? And so certain things that I just wasn't picking up on, when everything I thought was cool with my so-called friend, she was like, and it wasn't the moments of tension. It was the moments when I thought everything was cool. And my mother was like, I hate them. I don't like them. Something bad is going to happen to you with them. And I couldn't get it. And so Mom's had a plan and Dad had a plan. And the plan was, all right, I wasn't present with the plan, but I came home one evening and Mom and Dad said, listen, you're leaving. You and your mother are leaving and y'all going to Atlanta, Georgia, way before Atlanta was the Black Mecca. You know what I mean? And they was like, you leaving and you're leaving in 4 days. And they was busy. And May 7th, you know, we was living out of boxes. Stuff was in the U-Haul boxes. We was going. And and I get it, you know, so so-called friends, they knew that I was leaving. And as much as I'd like to say, yeah, my friends, they set me up and they did X, Y, and Z. Nah, I was more responsible for what happened to me because of the decisions that I was making. So they knock on my door that evening and ask me to come outside. And, you know, I'm supposed to be hustling with them. And I had never hustled. That wasn't my thing. And I'm out on a corner and I'm engaging in all kind of criminal activity and doing stuff I'm not supposed to be doing, right? And they didn't grab me and handcuff me and duct tape me and bring me outside. I walked out on my own volition, under my own power, to do this stuff, you know? Mm. And so as a man, you know, I teach my son, listen, at a young age, man, a sign of maturity is to admit when you are wrong, right? Right. Don't shift the blame. It wasn't the boogeyman. It was you. You dropped that, right? Admit it. All right. And that's a good place, right? And so I total admission. Like, yeah, I walked outside and so-called friends said, yo, when you come outside, don't bring the guns with you. Because I was the youngest one out of the bunch who's always carrying weapons. And so I go out with them. I had just been arrested for armed robbery a few weeks ago. And I had a case pending and I'm 15. And, you know, prior to me getting shot or prior to me getting involved in all of this kind of behavior, you know, criminality, I wanted to be a psychiatrist. I wanted to be a doctor. And so I knew what I wanted out of life, but the decisions that I was making wasn't lining up with what I had wanted to do prior to getting involved in this kind of lifestyle. And so, you know, when they said knock on the door and they said, yo, don't bring the guns, I was like, oh yeah, they looking out for me. But I go outside unarmed, carrying, you know, and not carrying a weapon. And so when I get outside, everything seemed normal for a little bit, you know. And like I said, it was May 7th. It was a Monday. It was about 7:30 in the evening. That day, I did not go outside at all until they knocked on my door. And that, which was so rare for me, because I was always outside. I wasn't, you know, back then, you were only in the house back then when I was a kid if you were sick or you was on punishment. You know, there was no reason to ever be in the house. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
How many video games you had? Nothing. So everybody was outside, but I didn't go outside all day. And I had so many brand new clothes from stuff that I had been doing. And it wasn't because mommy and daddy was buying it, just from all of the stupid stuff that I was engaged in. And You know, my mom, she couldn't, no matter how much she tried, she couldn't contain me, you know? So for all of the listeners that say, but what about your mother? And, you know, what could she have done? In all honesty, it was nothing she could have done unless she was going to sit in the, unless she was going to lock the door, lock my bedroom door and stay outside, stay like not go to work and babysit me. Like, cause whenever she turned her back, if she had to go to work and she said, go to school, I was like, yeah, all right, whatever. And I'm going the opposite way. Like, cause I have my mind made up. You can't make anybody do anything they don't want to do, you know? Facts, and so facts. I was focused on wanting to do it my way. You know, like Frank Sinatra said, I did it my way. I wanted to do it my way. And I wasn't going to, unfortunately, I was not going to get it until I had to experience it, you know? And when I say get it, in other words, what I mean is like, for some kids, you know, you tell them don't touch the fire on the stove, don't touch the pot because it's hot. And some kids get it. They just learn because you told them. And right. Some kids, as soon as you turn your back, you hear them crying. You go, I told you not to touch the pot. But you ain't got to never worry about them touching the pot again because they learn from experience. And mm-hmm. So I had to, unfortunately, I guess I had to experience this, you know. And so I go outside with them and I'm on the corner. And next thing you know, my so-called friend said, yo, we going to the store, the local bodega across the street. And I'm looking at him and they're like, all right, go to the store. He said, you want anything? And I said, nah, I'm good. And I watch him go to the store and he stayed in the store and he never came back out. And I didn't understand it. But before I knew it, I see this kid walking down a block and he's walking. It was nighttime now, you know, it's dark outside, about 8 o'clock or so. And I see him walking. And he ain't walking with nobody. And it's just him by himself and he's walking. And I see him. And as soon as he walks past me, I just remember turning my head, looking. I turned my head just to look back in the same direction he had just walked from. And when I turned my head, so he's now past me. Mm-hmm. And I turned my head and I looked the opposite way. All of a sudden, I hear somebody go, yo, look out. And when I heard him yell, I was like, oh, this ain't good. And I just took off and I started running in the same direction that I'm currently looking at, same direction the kid just came from. I'm running. And as I'm running, all of a sudden, I just remember just thinking, what exactly are you running from? And I knew the kid. I knew there was somebody behind me who had pointed a gun. I had been shot at before. I know that sound when somebody said, yo, look out. So when he said it and I looked over my shoulder and I'm running as fast as I can. And all of a sudden, I look and I see the kid pointing his submachine gun at me. And I turn back around, never stopped running, but I turn back around, I'm moving. And as soon as I remember just thinking, get low, because, you know, in the streets, you learn certain things, right? And so I was always told when somebody's shooting at you and you buy a wall, you run low, get close to the wall, and try to stay low and just keep running. And as I'm running, I'm thinking, I stay low, run. And, you know, I'm thinking, you're going to get shot. Just hold on. And as I'm looking, as I'm running, I'm just wondering myself, why are my pants making this weird movement? And I'm looking at my jeans and go, why they move like that just now? And soon I remember thinking, and then something hard hits me in the back. And the funny movements that my jeans were making, those were actually the bullets going through my legs. Mm-hmm. And the hard feeling I felt in my back was a bullet striking me in my spine. And it paralyzed me instantly. And I wasn't in any pain, and the kid ran off, and my so-called friends who were in the corner store, they, you know, nobody was there. Everybody was gone. And I just remember feeling like when the bullet hit me in my spine, it felt like a tuning fork. You know, when you hit a tuning fork, and it has that weird vibration. Mm. My body just felt like it was vibrating, and it just didn't feel right. I couldn't move my legs, and I just knew immediately, this is bad. Like, this is really, really bad, man. And I just remember looking and looking up in the sky and saying, God, please don't let me die. And as soon as the words left my tongue, I just felt peace, you know? So if I never believed and truly, truly believed that there was a creator before, I knew that he existed in that moment. And I remember just putting, you know, as I'm sitting on this ground, one person came outside and another person and says, yo, you're going to be okay. And he takes his jacket and he puts it underneath my head and he says, you're going to be okay. And as I'm laying there on the ground, You know, I'd have called out to God and I felt this peace come over me. And I just remember waiting out on that corner for like 20, 30 minutes. Just, it was like surreal. Just some people say watching your life flash before your eyes, but I wouldn't go so far as that. But just, you know, coming to peace with the idea that I'm going to die now, you know, now is my time, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just remember laying on the ground and police arriving, and I remember people from my neighborhood coming outside, and I remember, you know, them putting up the tape, the police line, do not cross tape. And I remember getting cold, and I remember having a hard time breathing, and, you know, just, I remember thinking about my mother, just a lot of thoughts. You just thinking a lot, you know, and just thinking. And one thing I remember thinking is, I hope somebody goes to get my mother, because I don't want to die like this on the corner by myself. I just hope I get a chance to die in her arms. I hope I get a chance to feel her soft hands one more time. I remember thinking those things. I just remember thinking, I hope somebody goes to get my mother, because I don't want to die like this. If I can just die with her next to me, I'll be okay. I don't want to die like this. And I just remember thinking that. And I remember the EMS workers arriving, and the EMS worker, white guy, he gets out the ambulance, and he gets down and he's kneeling and he's talking to me, saying, you know, what's wrong? I said, I can't move. And he's just saying, buddy, don't worry. You're going to be okay. I'm going to get you to the hospital. And I remember tapping him and saying, I'm just having a really hard time breathing. And he says, don't worry, I'm going to give you some oxygen. And he asked me, how do you feel now that I got, you know, he put the oxygen mask on my face. And I said, I can breathe a little bit better. Thank you. You know, and all, and I'll tell you what was so interesting is because when I got shot and I laid on the ground, I literally could feel the evil leave me. I could feel it leave me. It was as if I was laying on the ground and all of a sudden the world blinked and all of that bad that was in me left me. And I've often said, I guess the evil that exists in this world knew that it no longer needed me to go out and do all of this terrible things because I'm dead now. I'm gone. Mm. And I felt that little innocent kid come back. That kid that I hadn't seen in years, I felt him return. And like, you talk about self-hate, but there's a certain evil that exists in this world, you know? And I ain't the one to say blame it on the devil, but there's a balance. There's good in this world and there's bad in this world. You know, when we talk about, we say these kind of sayings to people, what got into you to do what you did? Why do we say, what got into you? Because something gets into a person that makes them think it's okay to go and do some of the horrific things that we do to humanity. Mm-hmm. Something got into you. Was it the spirit of greed? Was it the spirit of lust? Was it the spirit of anger? But there, something gets us into us vessels that allows us to do these terrible things that we do. And I felt it leave. And so this young white EMS worker is talking to me and I'm laying there and he says, you know, I'm going to get you in the ambulance and we'll get you to the hospital. And so I'm in the back of the ambulance. And as I'm, as he's putting me in the ambulance, I'll never forget seeing my, that they had removed my sneakers. The EMS workers had removed my sneakers, right? And Brother G, I saw I had white socks on. Don't you know, as I was laying on that stretcher, and I'm in the back of the ambulance, you know, ambulance, them lights is brighter than I don't know what, man. And I'm in the back of the ambulance. So I'm looking at all of the equipment. I got the mask on my face and I'm looking at the EMS worker. I see the white socks. I put my head down on the stretcher. And the first thoughts that go through my mind is, my mom's going to be proud of me. I got clean socks on. She's going to be proud of me. And see, my mother was one of those sticklers that I tell you, like, wear clean underwear, wear clean socks, because you never know what's going to happen to you. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw those socks, I was like, at least I did something right. I put my head back on that stretcher and I'm closing my eyes. And this EMS worker's talking to me, this young white guy. And he's like, how old are you? And he's saying, what grade are you in? What school? Now he's talking to me and the driver is driving. Now, I don't know this, but my mother's in the front seat of the ambulance. I don't know this, right? And so I'm in the back of the ambulance and the EMS worker's talking to me. It's like, oh, what grade are you? What school do you go to? What's your telephone number? And I'm trying to talk. And every time he'd ask me a question, he'd keep saying the same thing. don't go to sleep, stay with me. That's what he keeps saying. So he would say, hey, what grade are you in? What school you go to? Don't go to sleep, stay with me. Da-da-da-da-da. Don't go to sleep, stay with me. The more he said, don't go to sleep, stay with me, all I wanted to do, I just wanted to close my eyes and get some rest. I was so tired. And eventually I closed my eyes. I got real comfortable. I got that oxygen mask. And I was like, I'm not going to go to sleep. I'm just going to close my eyes and I'm going to answer the questions. And you know what I'm talking about, Mr. G? You ever had those moments where you're so tired and your daughter, little Maya, is talking to you and you laying on the sofa and you're like, uh-huh, yes, you got the cereal.
Yes, sir.
you know that good tired after a long day, you're like, baby girl, I'm right here. And I'm talking to my daughter and I'm like, uh-huh, You just drift off into that good sleep, you know? And I was like, and he's talking to me and he's like, yeah. I'm like, uh-huh. And I just, good sleep. But mine was that, the long sleep. And as I drift off, I could hear it. I could hear my voice and my voice began to say, I should have been a better person. I should have been a better person. I should have been a better person. And I could hear my voice and it was yelling those words. I should have been a better person. And as I heard that voice, all of a sudden, my soul floats out of my body and I am looking at my body and I'm looking at the equipment in the ambulance. I can see my face. And as my soul is descending, now I am looking at the bottom of the ambulance. I can see outside and my soul is going down and I can see the tar. I can see the dirt and I am going down into a dark space. And all of a sudden my soul stops. And when it stops, I turned and looked to my left. And it was a long, dark tunnel. All I could see was just black and darkness. And I turned and I looked to my right. All I could see was dark and black. It's just dark. And I turned back and I looked right in front of me in this dark, scary room. Faintly in the front of me, I could see these two doors. And something was telling me, you cannot stay here. You have to go that way. Mm. And I was like, okay. And I remember just getting closer towards the doors. And I stuck my hand out to go open up the door. I was going to grab the left door. And as soon as my hand got close to the doorknob, I hear from above me, I told him to take out the garbage. I told him to wash the dishes. I told him to take the movies back. I told him. And I heard her voice. And I remember just thinking, Ma, be quiet. I'm trying to go to sleep. And as soon as I remember hearing my mother's voice, and I yelled, all of a sudden, my soul just said, open up my eyes, and I'm back in the ambulance. I'm looking at the white EMS worker. He's looking at me, and I'm looking at him, and he ain't asking me no more questions, and he just starts yelling. He goes, I got him. I got him. Just keep yelling at him. I got him. Just keep yelling at him, mommy. I got him. Just keep yelling at him. Keep yelling at him. And I often said, man, had my mother not been in the front of that ambulance to yell and nag, I don't think I'd be here today.
That's amazing, man.
And they rushed me to the hospital, told me I was paralyzed. And those first few minutes in that hospital was, you know, nothing like they show you in the movies. It's nothing like video games. It's nothing like the music. You know, getting to the hospital, it's nothing like what you ever experienced and waiting in an emergency room. They rushing you through and it's scary. And then the doctors say, baby, this is going to hurt. And I remember cutting the side of my chest open and I'm yelling at the top of my lungs. And I remember them saying, rush him up to the operating room. I remember getting into that operating room and all of the surgeons got masks on. They tell me to look at the light, count backwards, starting at 100. I can remember hearing those surgeons say, we have a black male with multiple GSWs, multiple gunshot wounds. I can remember waking up hours and hours later in the ICU, not being able to talk because I got tubes stuck down my throat. I can remember my mother sitting right there in the ICU room, in that dark room, and all you hear is, beep, 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 beep. You hear all of these monitors around you. And just remember, you know, those months and those weeks subsequently after just being in that hospital. I had locks back then and I used to twist my hair and just go, what have I done? What have I done? You know, I remember those moments of just going, why me? Why did I have to get paralyzed? Why didn't I just die that night? Now the reality of my decisions have caught up to me. Mm-hmm. And the police caught the kid who shot me. And I remember I had been discharged out of that hospital in Brookdale in Brooklyn. And it's like in a Brownsville section, I think that's it. There's Brownsville, East New York. And so I had been discharged out of there. I'd been in there for like 28 days. My mother and dad never left my side. You know, they didn't leave my side for 28 days. And what I mean by that is my dad worked. So in the daytime he worked, and my mother would go home and get a little. In the daytime, my mother was there all day. My mm-hmm. dad would come home from, he would come from work. He'd come straight to the hospital, spend time with me. My mother would go home, get a little bit of sleep. And then before he left, she would return. She'd spend a night. I remember my mother slept in a windowsill for the first few days. And the doctors, they looked and they said, oh, so she's not leaving. And so they gave her a little cot to sleep on because she wouldn't leave my side. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was those moments that I really got a chance to reconnect with my mom and my dad, because there was a lot of anger that I had towards them. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it when I was running around in the street. You know, I couldn't quite figure it out. Mm-hmm. And so I had to have those moments of just saying, you know, I'm really, really sorry. I'm really sorry that I didn't take heed to what you were saying. I'm apologizing for not being a better son when I should have been listening, because I shouldn't have been in this situation. And my parents saying, I'm really, really sorry that I failed you. You know, we had to have those real moments and saying, you know what, we start from a clean slate today. And they said, I'll be with you. And I said, for now on, I'll listen to you. I got it. You know? And so I get discharged out of the hospital. I go to Rusk, NYU, 34th Street, 1st Avenue in Manhattan. One of the best, if not the best, rehab hospital in the state of New York. And so the police officers, the detectives come to my room and they say, we caught the kid who shot you. And I'll never forget, the police officer said, all we'll need from you is we need your signature. I said, I could do that. And said, when it's time to go to court, we're going to need you to testify and say, that's the kid who shot you. And I said, that's what I can't do. I can't do that.
People would say, why not? This kid just shot you, you know, however long ago. And I know you was angry about it. I know you wanted revenge. I know, you know, most people would say he deserves to be locked up or he deserves whatever. So why not, you know, go to court?
Those people would be absolutely right. I should have. But there's that dichotomy of, I was listening to the wrong voice. I was listening to the voice of the people that I thought, you know, the kids in the street. You know, when Adam and Eve, when they were thrown out of the garden, one of the things that if you read Genesis chapter 3, I believe, chapter 3 or 4, the creator asked Adam, he said, but I commanded you to do X, Y, and Z. And Adam said, you know, but the woman you gave me, she told me to do this. She gave me the apple. And in Genesis chapter 3, you know, Adam is penalized because God basically says, but whose voice did you listen to? Because I told you what to do, but you chose to listen to her.
Mm.
Right? And the reality is, I was listening to the wrong voices out there. I knew right from wrong. And I chose to, in that moment, not press charges because I was listening to the voice of, well, what are my so-called friends going to think? And I was concerned about what their opinion of me would look like. So maybe Adam was concerned about, if I don't eat this apple from my wife, she's going to look at me some sort of way, you know? And I chose not to press charges because I was concerned about what they would think. Hmm. Not what my mother would think, not what my father, not what my grandparents, but what are those people going to think? And I chose not to press charges. And unfortunately, that kid was released from jail. And I would say maybe a week later, while I'm still laying in that hospital. Now, this is June of 1990. So the kid was released this was probably like June or July, maybe July. So the kid is released from jail. And literally no more than a week or two goes by, I get a phone call from somebody in my neighborhood. And they say, you'll never believe what happened last night. And I go, what happened last night? The kid that shot and paralyzed you just shot and paralyzed your neighbor last night.
Wow.
And I said, nah, you gotta be kidding me. You lying. Nah, son. I put that on anything for real. Word up. Word up, son. He paralyzed. He can't walk, man. And I was like, nah, you lying. How you know? I'm telling you, he can't walk, man. And I couldn't believe it. I could, Brother G, I could not believe it, man. Mm. I said, what are the chances? And I felt responsible. Mm. I felt responsible because I knew that I had an opportunity to right a wrong here. And I chose not to. And I chose to let this kid go. And of course, I had no idea that he was going to go out and shoot and paralyze somebody else. And I didn't tell him to do it, but I know that I played a role. I let my community down on that one. I dropped the ball on that. Mm. And because of that decision, somebody else was paralyzed. And so that's where I kind of learned about the, I'll never forget when I was in the first hospital, Brookdale, for those 30 days, one day my mother came into the hospital and she gave me this book. And she said, Hashem, doctors say you're not going to walk anymore. And there's nothing that they can do. I can't write a letter. I can't write a letter on this one to figure out who to blame to get this corrected. Right. And your daddy can't beat up and shoot nobody for this one. We can't figure it out. But there's maybe the book has the answers. Now, she didn't say all of that. I can't write a letter and all that kind of stuff. But, she's saying this book can help you. Mm-hmm. And I looked at her, and in my mind, I was like, you're crazy. But I didn't say it because we had already made this agreement. Whatever you say, I'll listen. I got you, Ma. I got you. And the book was the Bible. She said, Hashem, I really need you to read this book. The answers are in here. And I was like, all right, Ma. Yeah, I pick it up. I read a page or maybe. I don't even think I could get through a page back then because I was just in so much emotional turmoil. I have moments of wanting to commit suicide. I have moments of revenge. Mm-hmm. I have moments of why me? My emotions was just spillovers. I couldn't. So maybe I got a paragraph in on a good day. Maybe. But then when I was in that hospital in Ruskin, NYU, and the cops, and I found out the kid shot, then the book was like, what's that glowing in my nightstand over there? I think I see something glowing in the nightstand. I don't think it's glowing, but maybe I'm seeing stuff. I was like, you need to read this, bro. This is the light, man. I told students, they say Bible stands as an acronym for basic instructions before leaving earth, man. Hmm. I said, I need to get some lessons and some instruction because I'm all the way lost. I'm all the way lost. And so I just began to read. And it was a story when I got to the end of Genesis, chapter 50. And Joseph's brothers had thrown him into the well. And now, he's the second in command. And his brothers was like, yo, I know you kind of pissed off about what we did to you 20, 30 years ago. And Joseph basically told him, I forgive you. Because had you not done what you did, then I wouldn't be in this position to help save many lives, And so what you meant for me for evil, God meant for good for me. And I realized that in that moment, I had done a lot of terrible things. And this kid walked up to me. He was 16 years old and he pulled out a submachine gun, a Tech-9 that hold 36 bullets. And he intended to kill me. Hmm. And I probably deserved each and every one of the bullets that went through my little body. But maybe in time, maybe God can do something good with this because he kept me around for a reason. And it was that moment of the shift of going from victim to victor, the shift of saying, why didn't I die from thank you that I am alive, the gratitude. That was the shift of going, either you're going to be a part of the problem or you're going to be a part of the solution in this world. It was a shift that was happening for me. And it was in that moment that I realized, you need to figure out how to put your priorities in order and realize what's important. So my allegiance, and I could no longer listen to the wrong voices. I had to really think about what I was doing before I was doing it. And And so it was like for me in that moment where I really learned the concept of forgiveness when I read that story from about Joseph. And the more I began to read, you know, and just realizing, yeah, I made some terrible decisions. And the scriptures is stories of people who made some terrible decisions. Mm-hmm. But it's also stories of people where our Creator is merciful and He knows how we are made, and He's given us second and third and fourth chances, you know. Mm. He cares about us. And so yeah, I just had to have that paradigm shift. The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I read a book years ago. This was way after I got discharged out of the hospital and everything. But Dr. Stephen Covey, the author of the book Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, he says in his book about the paradigm shift, and he says the way you see the problem can be the problem. Mm. You know, so yeah, so I had to. It was a real shift that needed to happen. I had to start looking at things a little differently. You know, so again, and that's in every facet of life, in every facet, whether I'm looking on the news and I'm watching something, I have to be very careful. All right, who am I listening to? I have to make sure that I'm trying to keep this balance and how I'm, how I'm compartmentalizing what I'm seeing and realizing there's good in this person. There's something that can come from this. So. It's always that shift, you know?
Yeah. That is so powerful right there, man. Just everything that you said. And I know people have different concepts of like forgiveness and things of that sort. So what do you say to people that's like, yo, this kid tried to kill you. Like this kid tried to take your life and now you're paralyzed and, you know, you're struggling mentally, emotionally, physically, everything. And you forgive him. And then also too, like that process of forgiving yourself. I know you said that the hardest part of the forgiveness was forgiving yourself. So can you get into those two things? Like when people ask, you know, why would you forgive somebody like that? And you had other opportunities too to exact revenge. I know you mentioned in a previous interview that your father asked you if you wanted him to take the kid's life. And I know there was probably other opportunities with things like that. So,
right.
What do you say to those? Like, yo, this is an unforgivable moment. This is a moment where this person changed your life forever. They need to hurt. They need to experience the pain that you're feeling. You know what I'm saying? And then the other end of forgiving yourself.
Well, I would say, you know, first I had people that would come. My dad was one of them. He was like, look, who was this kid who shot you? Who was it? Tell me who it was. And that person, you know, they got to learn what this is not the way. This is not the way. And I was like, nah, dad, you can't handle this. Because I remember laying in that hospital saying, I remember my soul leaving my body. And this ain't nothing to play around with, man. You know? And so that was one. And I had people and friends who would come and like, yo, I heard, you know, like I said, I ran with different people. And so one of my older, some other people was like, look, you know what I do. I get them. And I was like, nah, don't do it because, yeah, they wasn't worried about jail. They wasn't worried about retaliation and X, Y, and Z. But, you know, my soul left my body, man. Like, I realized, you know, we ain't nothing but breath, man. Man ain't nothing but breath. Psalm 39, I tell you, we ain't nothing but breath. We walking around with money and status and titles and all of that. And coronavirus has told you that thing will take your breath away and people be dead, man. We ain't nothing but breath, you know, how fancy who we are. And we gotta leave this place. We ain't here, but you know, they say the man don't live no more than 120 years. And those years go by fast, man. Like, you know, and that's if you're lucky. So I say all of that to say, like, telling my family and those so-called my friends, like, I don't want you to go to that place where I was headed to. And then as far as the forgiveness component, the reality is forgiveness is really a process, you know? So I didn't forgive overnight, you know? Like I said, it was emotional turmoil and spillover. You know, I was all over the place. I wanted to kill him. I wanted to kill his family, his mother, his friends, his cousin, his sister, his girlfriend, blah, blah, blah. I wanted everybody dead initially, you know? Mm-hmm. I didn't come out the hospital like, we are the world, you know? I wasn't singing that, you know what I'm saying? Nah, I wanted blood, you know? And, but the more I laid in the hospital, the more I began to realize that, again, I said, I have to hold myself accountable, right? And so for me, right, because everybody's forgiveness looks different, right? So for me, I could say, because I was actively engaging in this kind of at-risk behavior, that you kind of brought this on yourself. So you wanna walk around acting for woe is me? All right. So my story is a little different. You know, this is you know, the person who gets hurt because somebody, you know, runs into their house and does X, Y, Z. Everybody's story is different, right? With the when I say story, I mean a forgiveness story is different. So for me, I was able to compartmentalize and say, he shot you because you guys were doing bad stuff. Okay. Well, then I go, well, I didn't know him. Well, you had already done some stuff in the past, and this is why your bad deeds caught up to you. Now, you process that, and at some point, can you understand that what you ultimately did came back to bite you in the butt? Okay, yes. But he shot me, and I don't know him. All right, cool. These are the thoughts that I had to process, because forgiveness right. is a process. So then I said, okay, but he shot me, and I didn't do nothing to him. He got to pay. And then I said, but did you ever carry a gun? Yes. Did you ever shoot at someone? Did you do any of this kind of stuff? Yeah, I kind of did some stuff. And say, do you want them to run around hating you forever? Nah, I want them to let it go. Like, I was wrong. Well, then if you want them to let it go for what you did in the past, then you're going to have to apply that same degree of compassion to this kid. And I goes, all right, I got it. So that was part of my process of forgiving him, because I know that I was imperfect. Remember, the yin and the yang. We are not all good, and we are not all bad. So I go, okay, if this is what I'm seeking from people, hopefully, like, they won't one day say, oh, yo, remember what you did 45 years ago? Bam, here's your, I don't want somebody to let that go, right? Now I got to apply that with him. And then I say, yeah, of course, when it comes down to forgiveness, you know, they say forgiveness is a gift you give yourself, right? Me forgiving that person took time to get to that place. And there are times that I still get pissed off, right? Don't get me wrong. 30 plus years, I still have my moments where, you know, forgiveness is a verb. It's an action. This, you never like have mastered this thing, you know, but at least not for me. I haven't mastered it, but I'm mastering it. You know, you're always in pursuit. You're always learning new things. So forgiving him was easier. The harder part about forgiveness for me and my journey was forgiving myself, because again, that accountability and saying you were actively doing stuff you should not have been doing, and you gotta go. So every time I use my wheelchair, every time I have to put on these, you know, these orthotics, these leg braces to walk, and I get in my car has been modified for me to drive, and all of this kind of stuff, you're like, shucks, man. Every time I gotta go to the supermarket and I need a little assistance, that's forgiveness every day. I'm like, forgiveness. We not at 101 no more. I'm working on my dissertation of forgiveness, bro. Like, this is, I'm years deep into this forgiveness. Every day I'm forgiving myself. Like, God, man, you look what you did, bro. Look what you did to yourself. Man, you know, so every day I you know, you run into a new struggle, or you run into a struggle, just like, it didn't have to be this way. I didn't have to, you know, so this is constant. But when somebody says, you know, how do you forgive? Again, like I said, my journey of forgiveness is different than somebody else's. But I will say, for people who deal with holding on to people who have a difficulty forgiving, just remember that whatever the wrong was, okay, whatever it was, forgiveness allows you and that person to become unhitched. So what I mean by that is, at some point, even if the person, right, so you have stories about a person who's in jail for killing somebody else, right? A person kills somebody in a family, they kill the mommy and they kill the child, and that person is in jail, and the other family members are left stewing in, I can't believe it, and we knew the kid who shot him, and rah, 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 whatever the story is. At some point, when you are truly looking for that peace, that little Maya was talking about today, when you're truly looking for that peace and saying, you know what, I am tired of my story, the story of my life being so connected with that devastation. This is the forgiveness allows you to go, we're no longer connected now. Mm-hmm. This is bigger. My life is bigger than that moment. I am in a whole different place now. Yeah, I may carry the wounds, but you and I, we divorce now. I mean, divorce. Not like, no, I don't want my narrative and your narrative to be connected. Why? Because I forgive you. Because it was holding me hostage. I'm liberated now. And that's a process to say, yeah, I'm going to miss such and such who you took. But you know what? I am not going to hate you anymore. I don't want to lose sleep over you. I don't want to think about you. Like, and only that peace, only the creator in heaven can give you that kind of peace. Because that's truly what forgiveness is. It is peace on a whole nother kind of level. Mm-hmm. You know? And there ain't no Xanax, there ain't no pill that can give you that peace. Ain't nothing they can legalize. You can't drink that peace. Money can't give you that peace. A relationship with a new person can't give you that peace. Only the creator can give you that peace. And forgiveness is part of that peace. And it's a process.
Absolutely. That's a powerful message right there, man. Now, looking at the Hashim Garrett that's traveling around the world, inspiring young people and doing all this stuff. Obviously, this wasn't the same one that left the hospital and started, you know, rehabilitating and getting back to being able to do things again. So walk us through that process in, you know, your development into, you know, manhood and into being that person that, you know, is sharing your story right now. I think it takes a great deal of courage to be able to share your story and the honesty in the way that you do. So what was that process like for you to be able to, you know, do the work that you're doing now and share your story and be honest about it and the development of pretty much you after that whole process went down?
I would have to say still the same person. I really am. I'm still that same person. I'm still from Brooklyn, you know. I've had more experiences, you know. That person, Hashim at 15 is different than Hashim at 40-something as far as my experiences. I am who I am because of my experiences and the people that I've met along the way and who've deposited into me. And so I was who I was at 15 because of the people that I met, you know, the brothers at the school, the brothers when I was a little kid who was taking me back and forth to school. I was a product of the people that I met. I was a product of growing up in Bushwick and getting robbed and getting picked on, and the kids that I was engaged with and communicating with. Well, in 15, now I'm going to therapy and I'm meeting new people who are influencing me. You know, that's really what, for me, I am truly just a product of the people who have deposited into me and my experiences along the way, right? So hopefully, I'd like to really do a podcast. And at some point, if I'm able to do that, I will have to say...
Wait, we're gonna switch that up. You are going to do a podcast. That's what you meant, right?
Let me finish, right?
And yes, sir.
When that time happens, I would have to say it was because of Brother G who deposited into me to say, you can do this, you're going to do it. See, it's that moment. It's that moment where you interject and say, nah, that's going to happen, bro. And you go, thank you, brother. Because of the people that we meet, right? That's who you go. And so when they ask me, hopefully y'all will in a few years from now, and they say, well, how did you know you could do a podcast? And I'm like, well, it was the people that I met along the way who told me that I could do it. And well, how did you know that you could write a book? Well, it was the person who told me that.
and they just deposit it. And that's part of the reason why I do what I do, is just saying I am only who I am because of the elders and because of my village. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I was nearsighted before because of I wasn't around enough people, you know. So from 8 to 15, I was only associating people from a certain kind of background, kids that was in the gang. Hanging out with kids that are making poor decisions is absolutely fine. But just make sure you balance it out with the kids who are doing excellent in school. Make sure you balance it out with the kids who are playing the violin and on the swimming team. Make sure you hanging out, like, yeah, be well-versed, you know? And so then that way, when you get to a space, when you get older, you can be like, yo, I got a little bit of empathy for my young dudes that's in the gangs. Because I remember growing up with them. And I remember when that time when they asked me if they could come to my house because they were struggling. You know, I'll understand what they're going through. You know, and the same thing when the kid is on the basketball and the varsity team and they struggling and they beating themselves up. You know, I can be like, yeah, I can understand because my connections, you know, it's all about social capital, you know. And so it's just the people and the places and my experiences. You know, so I've been blessed to travel to Africa and see people that all look like me and touch the soil. And, you know, I've been able to go to Europe and be like, oh, wow, I thought Europe was so, so nice. Man, it's crazy cold and damp. Like, but that was, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't ever want to go to Europe like that. No disrespect to Europe, but like, you can get me to Africa way more than you can get me to Europe. It's cold and wet over there, man, you know? And so, but I only know that now because of my experience, you know, and I only was able to get to Europe because of the people that I met. So, show me who your friends are and I'll show you what your future looks like, you know?
Got it. Now, you know, like, if you've never shared your story, we wouldn't have, you know, this interview right now. We wouldn't have millions of young students. And I've seen you live in person, in action, looking around at the young faces, like the inspiration, man, like we wouldn't have that. And I feel like there's so many people in our communities that have these type of stories, things that they've been through, experiences that they can share with young people, share with the world, but they're afraid. They're like, yo, what if, you know, this don't go right? Or what if I get judged? Or what if it, you know what I mean? Like, what if I start crying in the middle of it? Or it's been tough and I don't really want to talk about it. So what do you say to those people that have these powerful stories that can influence and inspire so many people, but they just leave it in and they don't really share it because of fear, because of lack of confidence, whatever it may be? Like, what do you say to those people, you know, that feel like that?
Wow. That's a great question. Honestly, I would say that start small. Don't think about being in front of thousands. Just start small. Talk with one or two people. You know, get your feet wet with just getting comfortable. Just having conversations about whatever you've been through and whatever you want to share with somebody. And so, if you can have a conversation with one person, and then they say, "Well, wow, would you mind coming just to speak to my group at my church? Or would you mind coming to my classroom?" And you're like, oh boy, I don't know if I could do that because, you know, I'm afraid of being up in front of people. Just remember, whoever invited you to come speak, act like you're just talking to them again, you know? And so you don't focus on all 20 kids. Don't focus on everybody in the group. You find your friend who invited you, that colleague, your acquaintance, and you just stare at them for the first few minutes. And then you're like, okay, I'm getting my legs underneath me. And then you take your eyes and then you start and you'll look at all of the eyes and you'll see, and you know, the eyes are the window of the soul, and you'll make a connection with somebody else and you'll be talking. And you're not talking, you know, I've always learned, like, this message is not for everybody, but it's definitely for somebody. And there's somebody in that room who needs to hear what you have to say, you know, and you realize that there are going to be people who are going to walk out and be like, and then there are going to be some people who are just going to be like, thank you, I really needed that. And so don't miss out on the opportunity to help somebody else. We are only but a breath. We're only here for a short amount of time, you know. And so if you've been given, and if you have an opportunity to share,
your story, your message, then by all means do it. And you start off small, and before you know it, you're like, will you have those moments where you're afraid when you're in front of people? Yeah, that's normal, you know, but you'll find that one person in the audience and it becomes easy. But the moments of doubt where you say, am I being effective? Is it connecting? Is it resonating? Again, it's not for everybody. And there's going to be some people like, eh. And then there's going to be some people that are just like, yo, please just keep doing what you're doing, because it really does help. And just realize that, try not to just jump into it for monetary reasons, but just truly be like, yo, I just really care. And that will, your why has to be strong. Like, why are you doing it? And so, you know, please, you can reach out to me on my website, you know, HashimGarrett.com, and I can give you some more advice if you're looking for opportunities to be in a space to talk to some people. I could introduce you to some of my clients that I've worked with that, you know, are principals and administrators in schools, and they can say, hey, you know what, if that third party validation always means a lot. So maybe you might just be having a hard time, you know, getting over the red tape. And I could just say, hey, no, I really vouch for this person. They really want to do it. And so if I can be of any assistance in just helping network, you know, and making that connections, and you can reach out to me and we can talk and figure out what it is you want to say and however I can be of assistance. But yeah, definitely. Just like I said, just start off small, and just know that it's not for everybody, but it's for somebody. And whatever you have to share is of value to somebody. Mm.
Powerful, man. Powerful, powerful. No excuses, folks, not to get your message across. Share your story. Share your story. All right. I wanted to get into a quick activity here before we wrap things up. Call, what's your favorite? Just identifying a few of your favorite things, getting to know Hashim a little bit more. So, you know, I got to ask you what your favorite gangster movie is.
I'm going to have to say American Gangster.
Okay. Classic Denzel.
Mm-hmm. Denzel, you put Zelly in anything. And back in the days, I would have told you Scarface. I would have told you, you know, New Jack City. But if I'm real in my grown man swag, like when Denzel put something on it, when he put his imprint, you're like, yeah, that was fire. You know, what was the joint he did? The other joint that he did? Oh, man. Denzel, what's the thing he did? You know, King Kong and Got Nothing On Me.
Training Day.
That was a classic, you know? So, mm-hmm. So I'm a big Denzel fan, man. Got to give a shout out to that brother.
Gotcha. There's these whole memes now with, you just reminded me too, like of everybody doing the Denzel voice and the, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? His movies. Mm-hmm. There's so many, man. There's so many, but.
What about yourself, man? What's yours?
My favorite gangster movie? Ah, man. Whew. There's been so many, yeah. But I would say the Godfather, probably.
Mm, probably the Godfather. Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
No, I think just the way they went into the, like we just mentioned, like the whole interview, like it's more than just a gang. Like this is family. This is that. And I also think too, the Godfather has so many life lessons and so many gems in the movie. So it is, you know, one of my favorite because of that. Like not just the violence and all this kind of stuff.
Well, you know what? That part of the reason why I can understand, but it's those little moments where they say things like in the Godfather. You know, we give the drugs to the blacks because they're animals and all of that kind of stuff.
Those are the
learning moments, but you know what I mean? Yeah. But that's the kind of stuff that just stings to the core, like, ah, man, you know? So, but just to give you an insight to what people think about us, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I like the honesty.
Believe me,
of,
I get it.
Yep. Uh-huh. How'd this kid get this submachine gun? You know, like, where'd this all come from?
Right.
Like they said in New Jack, they don't make Uzis in the hood. You know? Mm-hmm. Where does stuff come from, man? So I like seeing things as they are too, man. I think And then right. seeing the Godfather, yep. the disdain for Black people, like, yo, let's give them the drugs. Let them lose their souls. You know what I'm saying? Like, yep. those are the things that I think are super important to look at, like the honesty and how these things are happening in our communities and what people actually think about us and stuff like that as well. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Man. I agree.
Speaking of gems, favorite gem that you got from somebody in your life?
Favorite gem. I put my pants on one leg at a time, just like you, brother. Yeah. Mm. Dr. Dwayne Dyson, an emergency room board certified physician out here in New Jersey. And he mentored a lot of Black doctor and he mentored a lot of other young Black doctors and been to his house and he's successful and he didn't have to do the work that he was doing. And I'm like, why are you out here? Why are you out here mentoring? You know, he had a program called Cops and Docs Violence Prevention Institute here in Jersey back in the early 2000s. Rest in peace, Sheena Dance. And so he said, why are you doing this, man? You got money. You know what I mean? What you out here talking to kids in the schools about? Violence, like, you know, I don't see this. He's like, yo, Hashem, you know, the life you saved may be your own. I was like, okay, that was deep, you know. And he said, but and I'm looking at him, I'm just like, man, you know, you got the money, you got the prestige. And he was just like, nah, I'm just like you, bro. I put my pants one leg on at a time, just like you. And I just was like, it was just the humility in that moment for me. And that's what I just took away, is just stay humble. You know, just stay humble. No matter who we are, you know, none of us, nobody's bigger than the next person. Nobody's better. Don't let the degrees, don't let the doctor and I'm this and I'm that and his friends as lawyers and we at his house and he got Peebo Bryson and Freddie Jackson singing at dinner. And I'm like, yo, I'm bugging. Like, yo, what in the world? I'm from the hood. How did I make this connection? And he's like, yo, you one of us, man. Like, you care. And I'm just like, wow, just a humble, down to earth guy, man. You know, so it's people like that. So that's and it's many lines, you know, many things that I meant along the way. That's just the first thing that popped out of my mind, just humility, man. And I've always admired that about people who are successful. You know, they're just humble with it, you know. Mm,
got you. And favorite thing about speaking to young people, I mean, I think you're an excellent speaker, man. You could be in the corporate office, in the boardroom, inspiring people, you know, all over the world and doing different things, man. But you chose to speak to young people, man. So what's your favorite part about that process?
Good question. I would have to say the favorite part about working with young people is getting to that place of seeing them be really transparent, and when they feel comfortable enough around me to just be honest and sincere and be vulnerable where they might not be with other people, and they walking around, they're like, nah, Sean, I don't care, nah, man, and all of that. And then they, you know what I mean, they got the facade, and they got all of that, and they say, nah, but I'm really scared. Mm. And they say, you know, like when they have that moment, they say, this is why I am the way I am. And you can see the tears welling up in their eyes, and they just admit that they lost. And then, so that's one part about it, saying, I know what it's like to be lost. I know. Mm. You know, and I'm just here to help you, bro, young lady. And then when, you know, because there's always those that stereotype of what kids are. Oh, this Black girl, the Black girls have attitudes and they're so tough, and this the boys is like this. And, you know, and we just sometimes people just don't realize all of the baggage that young people are carrying, you know. And so and it's no fault of the adults to, they don't always know how to get them to bring the guard down. You know, some adults really are well-versed in knowing how to, but the reality is, like, you're an educator, like, You guys don't get paid enough for being social workers and parents and teachers and this. You got to be the doctor, the nurse, the referee. Like, so that's a lot. You're asking a lot of educators, you know? And and the pandemic definitely hasn't made it any easier. It's worse, the shortages and everything. So I just come in and just, you know, just in addition to helping. And so that's the one component of the transparency and the honesty and sincerity. But then it's the other moments of when they just tell you in passing, keep doing what you're doing.
Absolutely, man. And I remember
when they say that to you, when they say that to you, you're like, and it always comes at a moment when, you know, you least expect it. Yo, are you that dude? Like, yeah. Oh, well, I remember this time when I was, I spoke at a college. Right before the pandemic, I spoke at a college and a kid came up to me, no lie, came up to me and he said, here it is, I'm in college. He says, you spoke to me when I was in my middle school. And I was like, oh, wow. And he said, what you shared with me in my middle school, I really needed to hear. He says, then I saw you when I was in high school somewhere else. And he says, when I saw you in high school, you said something to me. And in that moment, I really needed to hear it. And he says, here it is. Now I'm in college and I'm seeing you again.
Wow.
And you are saying something that I really needed to hear. I was like, I had to pick my mouth up off the floor. I couldn't believe it. And he was like, and he said, like, one time I was in upstate New York. The other time I was in the Bronx. And here it is. I'm in another part. Like, you know what I mean? And so I was just like, wow, man. You know, so it's just those moments of people just saying, you've left an impression on me and I appreciate it. So, you know, it's just to feel like, you know, like I said, again, in Genesis chapter 50, when his brothers told him, Joseph's brother said, you know, I know you upset with us. And he said, no, but you know, this was supposed to happen for many people to stay alive. Like, so, you know, I'm far from Joseph, but it's just like, maybe I didn't die on May 7th, 1990 because there's something that I'm being used to help others.
That's why. That is so powerful, man. I know you mentioned too in a previous interview that a lot of this stuff that you're teaching, man, like, and through your story, these kids don't get an opportunity to learn in school, man. Like, just those powerful life, you know, things like decision-making, like from somebody that made really bad decisions and, you know, your story being involved in the game, all that stuff, like, those opportunities when, you know, you test prepping all year long for whatever class, or, you know, just don't come, man. So I think that that is just a unique experience, man, to have somebody like you come through and really shed some light on reality and life and everything. So amazing work, man. Yeah, man. And speaking of COVID, you know, you just your whole process with, you know, recovering from depression and everything, like, what's been your favorite thing to do for your mental health?
Exercise, trying to get my weight up and stuff like that. Just doing a lot of study and reading my scriptures a lot, you know, taking it, you know, reading my scriptures, not through the Christian lens, not from the Jewish lens, not from the Muslim lens, just clean slate, just really reading it all over again and taking that in. And like I said, I'm back in college now. So just kind of just keeping myself, just trying to find that balance, you know, rediscovering who I am, just as a person, because so many of us, we get caught up in who we are, right? We say like, hey, my name is Mr. Garrett and I'm a consultant. I'm a motivational speaker. You say, hey, who are you? Well, I'm Mr. G and I'm an educator. And who are you? And so we always start off, right? I'm a husband, I'm a father, and I'm this. Mm-hmm. Well, when the pandemic happened, it was like, you ain't no motivational speaker right now. You in a house quarantine, brother. And the world is looking real different right now. And I was just like, I had grown so accustomed to, you know, being out on the move, always traveling. And I was sitting in the house like, I ain't used to being in a house like this. This is crazy, you know? And I'm not talking to people. And I was so, just had to rediscover, like, you know, recalibrate, who exactly are you? And so just spending some more time with myself. So that's a little bit of it, doing a lot more cooking, taking care of the house, taking care of family, you know, being present and reading the scriptures and exercising. So a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Got you. Yeah, man. And I know we mentioned some of your favorite parts about the work that you do, public speaking and everything. So, you know, for those that like, yo, you know, what you're doing is amazing. Like, you're telling people your story, you're traveling around the world, like doing this and that and the third. But is this stuff like, can you make a living off of this stuff? Is this stuff like, can I satisfy my family, my wife, my kids, and have a house and do all these type of things, you know, doing, you know, public speaking and being an educational consultant? So like, you know, I'm not asking how much money you make, you know, but what could people that want to get involved in what you do, like, what can they expect, like, financially?
I would say that it's, one, you're going to be self-employed, you know, at some point if you plan on doing this full time. So realize that, as with anything, you know, what you reap is what you sow. You put a lot of work into it, then you should expect a big reward. If you go half-assed with it and you don't put a lot of effort into it, don't expect to eat too much. You know, it's not, you know, when you work and you go to somebody else's job, they paying you, you know. You can show up and you can do half the effort, and then, you know, unless they fire you, getting paid. You know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. But being self-employed is totally different. You don't put no work in. I mean, I don't know, you know, so if you're willing to put the work in, and over time, yeah, it could be very lucrative. I don't do bad, but there are those that would probably, they would die if they saw the money I was making as other motivational speakers. They would, what? They would find it. They would not be happy with my money compared to what they're making. You know what I'm saying? But I also realize the line of work that I'm in, as far as a motivational speaker, you know, it all depends on what kind of speaker you, what kind of, who your audience is. Mm-hmm. So if my audience is serving, you know, young Black people, oh, you're not going to make the Tony Robbins kind of money. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not, because they are speaking to, you know, corporate America. You're not going to make the Les Brown money. Will you do well? Yeah, you can do well. Yeah. So, I mean, it all depends, really. So if you know who your audience is and you want to talk about money and stuff like that, maybe, you know, there's a podcast, Earn Your Leisure. Those guys are really big and it's all about financial literacy. Well, if you talk about money, and then there's avenues where you can make a lot of money, to answer your question, but a lot is relative, you know? So yeah, there's money to be made in it. But know your audience and understand that it does take time, but just don't jump into it just for money. Like that would be my only thing. Like, I'm not telling anybody what to do, but don't let money be your only motivation. That's what I would say. I'm not going to tell you don't jump into it for money, but just don't let that be your only motivation, because there are going to be times that money won't be looking like that. So you want to make sure, you know, that you have, you have, when the times is running low and money, people are not booking you, that at least you can be like, hey, well, I do this because I love to do it anyway.
Absolutely. Great points, man. Great points. I think it is all relative, and your purpose into why you're doing what you're doing, super important. All right. So when the Hashim Garrett movie is coming out and we're all going to the theaters to see it, and okay. Your life is being portrayed. Like, what do you want people to remember about your legacy, what you represented, and to understand once they leave those theaters and once they, you know, they finish seeing everything, what do you want them to remember about you and the work that you did and what you represented?
Well, I guess I would have to say, good question. He was a person who was just a man after God's own heart, really just trying to do the right thing with the time that he was given. And he loved all people, you know, Black, white, Asian, everybody, Latinos, and was a man for the people, really trying to help people, you know, and for those who were less fortunate, you know? So whether it's the single mothers out here, whether it was the kids who didn't have dads, whether it was those who was missing meals, like, he really cared for the people, man. you know? And yeah, that would be my main thing. Just try to help those who are in some difficult situations.
Got you, man. Powerful, man. Like I said, man, the work that you do is much needed work. I've seen the results myself, looking around young faces, young Black faces, and seeing like, yo, this dude gets me. Like, he gets it. Like, just that type of experience, you know, I feel like a lot of young Black kids don't get to have, where they're like, yo, this dude really knows what time it is. He gets it. He understands me, and his story's powerful, and I can relate, and all this kind of stuff, man. So, you know, like I said, I appreciate, you know, your body of work and everything that, you know, you're doing when you're speaking, and your honesty, and, you know, just sharing with us. We need more Hashim Garrett, man. So I appreciate the work that you've done, man. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for your honesty. I know those of us that are listening, we might want to know, like, where to get more Hashim Garrett. Where can we reach you? Where can we find you? So can you let us know where, you know, people can find you?
Sure. Well, first, let me just say, listen, man, you did a great job. This was a lot of fun. You know, initially when we talked, I was like, nah, I'm only going to be able to give an hour.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I appreciate it, man.
I'm only really, man, got an X, Y, and Z, but it just felt real natural, man. So it was a real pleasure, man. Just felt genuine, you know? And so as far as where people can reach me, they can definitely email me, Hashim Garrett, Gmail, website's the same, HashimGarrett.com. They can look me up on YouTube, and so those are the main, you know, always Facebook, and it's Hashim Garrett, and Instagram is Hashim_Garrett. So you know, everything is just pretty much Hashim Garrett. It's all streamlined like that. Yeah, that's where you could be reached. And like, again, I just was really good to just have this conversation, and you did a great job with all the questions, and you know, your little one with her questions in the beginning. So
I appreciate you. A lot of folks don't know, but my daughter does like a pre-interview, warms the guests up. So yeah, I appreciate, shout out to Maya, my daughter. But yeah, man, appreciate you coming on. Appreciate the extra time. Of course, one last thing, we always ask all the guests to leave us with their favorite quote and what it means to them.
The journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step, you know? So no matter whatever the goal is, the things that we're trying to accomplish, just get started, you know, and keep moving and don't stop. So the journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. So whether you plan on going to medical school, or you want to, you know, you've got a goal, you want to, whatever it is you want to do, it may seem like it's going to take you forever, but as long as you just one step at a time and you keep moving, before you know it, you will have accomplished what you've put your mind to attaining. So just don't give up, perseverance, you know?
There it is, man. There it is. Powerful, powerful, powerful. Listeners, please share the program with young people that are struggling, parents that are struggling and don't know what to do with their kid that's not coming home on time and getting involved with the wrong people. Like, they need to hear this. They need to hear the realities of life and these kind of stories, man. So please share with people that need it. Please share with everybody. And again, appreciate you. And listeners, of course, remember, your mind is the most powerful tool in the universe. Therefore, if you can think it, you can do it. If you believe in it, you can be it. And if you fight for it, you can have it. The world is yours. This has been your host, Mr. G, and I will see you next time on Mastermind.